And we'll just open with a word of prayer.
Okay. Lord, we thank you so much for your love. You're breaking in the history so that we didn't just stumble around here in the dark trying to find this way. Your goodness, your good heart, your aggressive heart that came in kindness and shared with us in tenderness and warning and encouragement and challenge and instruction. And we hope we'd pay attention and learn and see the depth and the beauty of your word again tonight. And that we would be warmed by the knowledge of your companionship with us in life. And as we go and explore each day and see what's out there, to know that you're with us. And we just thank you for this time and these eager hearts here. And we ask that you'd bless this time for your son, that we would fall more in love with him and honor him with our choices and our, the delight of our heart. In Jesus' name, amen.
Okay, I'm only working with about half of my sinuses here, so if I sound a little nasal, that's courtesy of my organisms that are much, much smaller than I am, although I aspire to be that size again someday. So we are in our syllabus. We're on Psalm 2, and that puts us on what page is that? That's page. Let's go to page 12, and what we're doing is we covered Psalm 1, and Psalm 1 was, of course, the introduction to the book of Psalms. There's 150 Psalms, divided into four books. And the first book started with Psalm 1. Psalm 1 was the one that set the tone that said, you sink your roots deep into the Word, and then you just grow. You feed, you grow, you bear your fruit, you get through the winters, you get through the summers, you're just steady, and this is what it's about. Psalm 2 we're in now is applying that in a wartime situation. There's wars going on, a tremendous amount of difficulty that the king is facing. Psalm 3, we're going to have family troubles and court intrigue. And Psalm 4 is going to have another level of court intrigue. So we're going to see what it means, psalm by psalm, all the difficulties of life, all the joys, all the treasures. We'll have abject betrayal. We'll have abject... hi, come on in. We'll have abject failure. We'll have just about everything that you experience within humanity in human life. Three additional pages to put in the back of your binder there. We'll have those. And Psalm 2 we're on. The way we do this is we read it from the Hebrew interlinear. And just so that you see, somebody ask, why do we do the Hebrew? And that's just so you see the word order that they used it when they would have read it. And so, because the word order sometimes, remember, had that punch to it that the English translation that tries to smooth it out. And so that's what the whole point of interlinear reading is about. And then we read it in the English translation, and then we go through the quotes. And I'll try to make comments about the words as we go through them. So what we're going to do first is on page 12 is I'm going to read the Hebrew interlinear, which is under the Hebrew there, and Hebrew reads right to left. So I'm going to start over in the right column there and read left, you know, to the left, and just follow along with me, and I'm going to make comments about some of the words before we get into the actual detailed quotes from the reference materials. So it starts out with a why. Why do they rage, the nations? And the peoples, they plot vanity. And remember, vanity was that emptiness word. It wasn't vanity like looking in the mirror kind of vanity. It's just a futility, just fruitlessness. Okay, they take a stand, the kings of the earth and the ones ruling. They gather together against Yahweh, the Lord, and against His anointed one. And we talked last time that there were three words in the Hebrew for God and Lord. Elohim, which was the title for God. In the English, that was uppercase G and lowercase. So those are the words in the English translation are Elohim, and this is God's title. Sometimes people are called Elohim. Rulers are called Elohim. Adonai is just a general word for Lord or Mister, an expression of respect. When I was a 10-year-old, and if I were addressing a parent or an adult Hebrew, I would use Adonai. I'd use it so it was like Sir or Mister. It's also used of God in his magisterial role. And then Yahweh, and then in the older English, we had Jehovah, was the personal name of God, or better yet, the covenant name of God. When God gave the Mosaic covenant, in the Abrahamic covenant, when he made a special covenant contract with Abraham to protect Abraham, and this, he revealed his personal name, and his personal name was Yahweh. And we talked about, we were not exactly sure, you know, I am that I am is how it's translated sometimes. I will be that I will be. I live and live. And so all that we know the word actually means is that it's more real than we are. Basically, that's what it's saying. It's more alive, that God is more alive than we are, more real, more substantial than we are, and we aspire to that. We can build on that. So that's what that word. There's actually a fourth word that is not used of God. It's another Lord word, and it's never used of God, and you'll understand why. It's the word Baal. It's another word for Lord. And in all the other cultures, instead of Adonai, they might use the word Baal, but Baal is also the name of one of the worst deities that the ancient Near East has ever had. They do child sacrifice to this dude. His religious rituals involve things that are illegal to do sexually in normal countries. You know, it was just a blood ritual, a lot of blood sacrifice involved, usage of blood in sacrifice. And God has never called Baal as an address. Now, Baal shows up in names sometimes, Balaam, Zerubbabel. You know, they'll show up as a part of a name, like Yahweh will show up as a part of a name. All the names that end in Yah, for example, you know, Zechariah, all the Uz have God's personal name on them. So that Ah and the Ayah at the end of all, you know, the biblical names, Obadiah and Jeremiah and Zedekiah and all those Ayahs, they all include the name of God in that as a covenant reminder. The parent would name the kid something to, you know, keep them ever in their face what that word means, right? My name, Glenn, means like a forest. So I always remember that I'm lost in a forest. So I'm always lost in the fog, walking around, you know, don't know where I am. So that's why I was named, just so I'd always be humble with the name Glenn, right? So, but Baal is a word, you'll see this constantly, the other people will call Yahweh Baal. So the Philistines, when they're talking about Israel's God, they may call him by the Baal term. See, but never would an Israelite prophet call God Baal. Now, this word right here, though, is that personal, intimate word, Yahweh. So, this is Yahweh that has revealed his heart, his intentions, and his purposes to the Israelites. Against Yahweh and against his anointed, that's that Meshach word that we get the word Messiah from, remember? We talked about there were basically four kinds of religious or political figures in the Old Testament: prophets, priests, king, and wise people. And of those four, the first three were always anointed. It was like their rite of inauguration, like we would have a president swear on a Bible or something of this type, or putting on a robe at graduation. You know, those rituals and things of this type. This was always done with anointed. And so Samuel, the prophets would always carry like a wine bag around filled with oil in case God wanted them to anoint somebody for special service. So they would go to special meals in the towns. And so when God sent Samuel to anoint David, David was a shepherd, remember, and at the time Saul was king. Saul was the first king of Israel. And Saul wasn't doing very well. He wasn't obedient. He wasn't paying attention to what he was supposed to be doing. And God was sorry, to use God's expression, he was sorry that he made Saul. He put Saul in over his head, basically. And Saul didn't rise to the challenge, didn't pay attention, didn't learn, didn't access the resources of grace that were available to him. And then he failed in that ministry. And so God sent Samuel to the David's family in Bethlehem. And the excuse was they knew better than tell Saul that they were going to anoint a new king while Saul is still king. This is a very dangerous move, as David discovered for the next 6 or 8 years, running from Saul trying to kill him. And so when Samuel goes to Bethlehem, God says, okay, well, they're going to have a cult meal. They're going to have like a potluck, a religious potluck dinner. That's going to have teaching. The prophet Samuel is going to teach. And he makes sure that David's parents have invited all the children. And they, and God's going to tap Samuel on the shoulder and say, this is the one, anoint him. Take him off on the side and get that bag out and put the anointing oil on him. And if you remember how the story runs, the first six kids are there. The oldest brothers of David are there. And Samuel keeps thinking, oh, this is a good-looking guy, sharp guy. This must be the one. And God says, no, that's not him. And they go on down the line. There's nobody there. And Samuel asks David's father, is this all the kids? He said, no, we have one other small one. He's out taking care of the sheep. He said, well, we're not going to eat. He was a smart guy. We're not going to eat till he's here. So he knew how to get him motivated. I mean, that food's going to get cold. We're not going to do it. So go get this guy in the field. And so they bring David in, and Samuel senses that this is the right one, puts an oil. And David is actually anointed three separate times in his life as king. Remember that he's anointed king here, and then he runs for 10 years. Thinking, so Lord, what was this all about? you anointed me for this thing, right? And he gets anointed later by the tribe of Judah and then by all 12 tribes again. But anointed was that special thing. It marked you out as a ceremony. You were on the hook. Your life was now in a fishbowl. It was a unique set of responsibilities. But it also came with a special access to God in these days. And it was when you knew at that level that you had a calling, that God had marked you out for something. Okay, you paid attention because there were huge risks, like you would see in the case of Saul, of failure. But if you didn't walk with the Lord every day, your life would show it, and then they would take its toll. Now, of course, that's a huge lesson for every normal mortal. Duh. Those of us that are tasked with things even more important than kings. You know, friendships, spouses, children, you know, relationships like that. To sit there and make sure that every single day we're doing what we're supposed to be doing because of God's call on our life individually. So the anointed, this of course was the king, the messianic king, which we'll talk a lot about in a few minutes. Then verse 3, these nations out here that are overthrowing, that are upset about God, let us break up their chains and let us throw off from us their fetters. Okay, so they're banding together, they're upset. They're raging against the Lord and against His King, and say, "Let's throw off these shackles of bondage." As we'll see, you know, they do like we tend to do. They overstate the difficulty. They overstate how bad things are. They characterize this relationship with the King of Judah as being one of just fetters and bonds and chains, and you know, when it wasn't even remotely like that in practical life, which we'll talk about when we get into which nations we're talking about. So they have this just dramatic statement. The one being enthroned in the heavens, and that's, of course, the Lord, he laughs at Adonai. That word there, Lord, is Adonai. So when you get into verse 4, the one being enthroned in the heavens, he laughs Adonai. You see there's the Lord with the capital L, the lowercases O-R-D. So that's Adonai. Remember, if it's all uppercase, it's the word Yahweh in the English. Okay. He scoffs at them. So at first, this is amusing that these little petty folk would try to get upset with this and amusing. And then 5, then he rebukes against them in his anger and in his wrath. He terrifies them. In other words, he realizes that all of a sudden that this rebellion is not just by two or three people in a tent. These are by kings that are now going to involve all of their kingdoms and all of their subjects in warfare and the damage that it's going to be to the normal lives of people and to the land and things of this type. This is a matter that involves his attention. And so it swiftly moves from, you know, chuckling over, five-year-olds are going to run away from home, you know, to people that are now terrorists and are going to attack your nation and destroy your, you know, your villages and upset everything. Right? So now all of a sudden it's a different issue at the scale that we're talking here. He then rebukes against them in his anger and his wrath. He terrifies them. Indeed, I have installed my king. So God is speaking. I have installed my king, Melech. That's the word for king. My king on Zion, the hill of my holiness. And we talked last time about what Zion was, and we drew of the city of Jerusalem. That looks more like a, well, never mind. Doesn't look much like a city of Jerusalem. But the city of Jerusalem, here's the square of the old city. And you actually, now's a good time to look at your handout. Look at the very last page of what I handed you is an aerial photograph of the city of Jerusalem. Okay? And if you'll look, there's, you can see a wall in the foreground. Okay, and that wall, that white wall, you can see how it goes all the way around the city. It goes all the way around the city. And that's what this is supposed to be, is roughly that wall. Now, that wall is the old city. At the time that David is writing Psalms, he did not live in what will later become the old city. He lives over here on the bluff, and there's a key there. You can see down at the bottom right corner, there's Mount Zion. And right, Mount Zion on the bottom right, and above it a little bit, you see City of David, and it's outside the wall. And so down here, Zion is like the high point of the high points in the city. The City of David is out here, because of course there is no, you know, Jerusalem at this point. It's just the city of Jebus. The Jebusites live there. But he's taking the high ground. There's a very sharp bluff. It's very protected, and like I say, you tried to live on high ground as best you could. Now, I worked on this to show you what, to give you an idea of what the sizes here we are. The size of this old city is about 3/4 of a mile by a mile on the corners. Okay? That's the, physically the size of Leland. Leland's only, is slightly larger than that walled area, actually, geographically. However, it would have housed inside, and most of the people lived outside the wall with the pastures and the animals and things of this type. It would have had approximately the population of like Greenville, the 30,000 range area, but because they would have all been out on the pastures and tents and smaller buildings. But inside the wall building, of course, where the rich people lived and artisans and some of the merchants and things of this type, they lived inside the city. So it's very small. But the city of David, the Zion city, was only 2 football fields by 1 football field. It's very, very small. Very tiny area. It's very well protected, and that's where David, you know, would have had his military commanders, and everybody else would have lived over here. Now, on that diagram, if you look, and this is, of course, the diagram is like this, you know, because we're looking to the east here. The temple over here, you'll see the Temple Mount, that big round bubble in the middle, right up in here. That's the Dome of the Rock. Boy, that's the Muslim holy site that's built on the right half of the temple area. So David, if you remember, David lived down here, and there was no temple when David, remember, it was still in the little tent that they carried around on the poles and stuff, the tabernacle, basically, you know, that they carried out of with Moses. There's a judgment that comes. God stops the destruction of Jerusalem, David's little area, on the threshing floor of Araunah, and David buys the threshing floor of Araunah because that's where, you know, God stopped the punishment, a plague on Jerusalem, and that became the site for the Temple Mount. So that became where they built the temple later, inside the wall. So the city of David was this outside area. It grew into this area over time before expanding to the old city. Okay. So Zion, when they heard Zion, Zion was the safest place to be for 2 reasons. One, geographically, it was very, very high. It was the highest point of elevation and therefore defendable. But it was also the place that God had picked. God had said, "Yes, I'll put my name in this city." Okay. Now, also in the back, in one of those handouts I handed you, on page 25, if you move up forward to, you'll see a point I was making last week about the elevation. And I think, did I draw that? No, I don't guess I did. On the map, I talked about here's the nation of Israel, where all the biblical history occurs. Here's the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. Of course, Jesus grows up in this area, Nazareth. Sepphoris, Tiberias, you know, that's all in here. The Dead Sea, directly across from the top of the Dead Sea is Jerusalem. Jericho, this is the River Jordan that connects the two. Jericho that Joshua and them came across and Joshua fought the battle of Jericho. Remember that song, right? So they come across there. That's right there, sort of on a parallel. And then Jerusalem, you know, goes out to the Mediterranean Sea. We talked last time about the scale of this, that from the Dead Sea to here is from Greenville to Greenwood. It's only 50 miles from here to here. From here over to here is about 60 miles here to Clarksdale. Up here from the Sea of Galilee to the Mediterranean is 17, 20 miles, one day's journey back in those days if you pumped it, you know. And almost all of biblical history occurs in this little area, tiny little area relative to what we live. All of the life of Jesus is there. He goes out once or twice up in here. And we'll have a bigger map when we talk about these enemies that are along here, that David is talking about the nations in the Exodus and things of this type, of course. But the vast majority of history occurs within this very little narrow range. And the elevation, of course, it goes from sea level up to this green area that I drew here, which was a mountain range. So this was general sloping up to the high point was the mountain range that here, the hills of Judea, the hill country, you'll see it in the Old Testament, the hill country of Judea. Then there's a strip right between it and the Dead Sea called the Wilderness of Judea. So a lot of several of the Psalms are written in the Wilderness of Judea, where David is hiding in those caves from Saul. And then the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is as low as Jerusalem is high on that map. So this is looking to the north, as if I were standing down here looking back up this way at sea level. You can see that Jerusalem is about 2,500 feet high. And the Dead Sea, the bottom of the Dead Sea, is 2,500 feet below sea level. Okay? So there's essentially a mile difference in elevation here. And so Israel, Jerusalem is pretty well defended against attackers coming up the mountains. And in fact, when you attacked Jerusalem, you always attacked from the north, where the mountains were sloping up. So you would go up a slope of mountains coming down this area. So all the prophecies in the Old Testament where they talk about destruction comes from the north and the Babylonians' judgment comes from the north and all this, even though Babylonia is way south of these dudes, you can't get across these mountains in the deserts, and they have to go up the Tigris-Euphrates, that fertile crescent, remember we talked about, come up into Syria, touch into Turkey, and then come down Syria and Lebanon to attack this land. So that's the way it would. Assyria was up here, Babylonia was down here, and you'd have to go this way. And so you'd come up these mountains. And the other diagram, if you look at the, not the other picture, but back to that little map, you can see in the top right corner the Dead Sea. In other words, it's 15 miles from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, from here to Indianola. But because of this elevation difference, you can see it. It's off in the distance, ever so barely, but you can actually see the Dead Sea. You can see things coming at you if they were going to approach from that side. Now, they would normally be coming through those hills, so you wouldn't catch them, you know, because there'd be plenty of stealth opportunities. But it's a very small area, very, very, very small area. And it was eminently defendable, you know, unless God wanted you to be captured. This is a different story we'll talk about the prophets, right? Okay. So this was the Zion thing I wanted to mention. Let's stop. Okay. Where was I? Install my kingdom on the hill of Zion, the hill of my holiness. 7. I will proclaim the decree of Yahweh. There's that covenant name again. He said to me, son of me are you. This day I became your father. So that's a very, you know, doesn't have a lot of verbs in it, so it's a real punchy, my son, you are. My son are you. And there's no R there, it's just my son, you. Okay? I, your father, today. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance and a possession for the ends of the earth. And so this was when a king, and we'll talk about this in detail, when a king ascended the throne in the ancient Near East, they were always they had a ceremony like this where whoever the patron deity was typically in some way put their mark on them and said, "You are ruling in my stead. You are my son." And sons, for all the pagan nations, the sons literally meant somehow that the god was involved in conception. They had some very strange notions of this, how that worked. There was not a slightest hint of that in Israel theology. There's just nothing like, you know, Zeus being the father of Hercules or anything like this through, you know, some wife or whatever. But the whole point of sonship, where you had two functions as a son. You were supposed to do two things. You were supposed to actually work for the agenda of the father. You know, you were like going to have the company business, the family business, and you were like a vice regent. Okay, you were a co-ruler, and you were supposed to represent faithfully the interests of the father, because it was also yours. And you were also supposed to be the spitting image of the father. You were supposed to reflect the father's character, the father's heart, the father's directives, you know, values and things of this type. They were supposed to be this perfect matchup between the image of the son that was ruling on the throne and the father that's in heaven. And the history of Israelite kings, of course, is notorious for that not being the case. The closest we have, and the one that was the most of the time, was a man of God's heart, was, of course, David. That's the closest we get, and there's some notable failures, but still, even in the way he dealt with some of his failures, you can see a heart of humility and eagerness to help other people. Okay, so this was a coronation element, and we'll talk about the covenant that preceded that and brought that. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance and your possession the ends of the earth. As I mentioned last time, when a royalty, even in England, or anywhere for that matter, comes to of age, they then get moved from the boarding school and the military schools where they were supposed to be learning self-control. They now get all their money. They get parts of their inheritance, and you hope that they had learned from the self-discipline, that they had learned from the things that they had suffered, to use the phrase Hebrews uses of Jesus, by the self-control of discipline and doing the right things, that then when they get all this power, that they just go hog wild and go on spring break. You know, they literally will stay focused and then leverage that for the same heart and the same good that provided them that inheritance and provided them that discipline and training. That's what you hope, right? Okay. And so they enter this, and because of the relationship between the father here and the Davidic king, because they're like the heart, they say, just what do you want? You know, I've already made you the ruler over Israel, but are there other nations you'd like to? You know, it's a leverage thing. It's not a greed thing. It's more like, are there other departments you'd like to clean up and work and run and fix and leverage and things of this kind? What else do you want? Because that's what the Israelite kingdom was supposed to be. If you remember the promise, the covenant, Mosaic covenant, he says, I will make you a kingdom of priests. See, that Israel's whole calling was to go out and get the rest of us broken down Gentiles. And that's what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to evangelize us. They were supposed to go out there and tell us the glories of their God and beauties of his heart as shown in the Exodus and all this kinds of stuff. You know, and of course, you know, they didn't. But that's what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to go out into all the nations and give us the good news and let us know and bring us in to the fellowship and the knowledge of God. And so that was their calling, to be a kingdom of priests. Priests in the Old Testament were teachers, basically. They did some of the sacrifices, but not a lot. But they were largely teachers. They were supposed to travel around and teach. And they were like teaching priests. You know, they would travel around teaching preachers. Verse 9, you will rule them with a scepter of iron, like an article of one making pottery. You will dash them to pieces. And we pointed out that pottery could not be repaired in those days, and these were irreversible. That if somebody literally was a big enough troublemaker in the ancient Near East and had enough potential to do damage, on a large scale damage to the people around them, that you had to break them irreparably. And that was like a war or invasion or something like this, and you would destroy their culture. But it's an interesting thing about all the nations that God pronounces all the judgments about, and he ends up, you know, doing some destruction to all of them. I can't find any of them that he doesn't also later in the prophets say, and I will restore the fortunes of X, Moab, Egypt, Sodom. this is that the God of patience who struggles to make a way for reconciliation. So he had to do judgment, you know, because, I mean, they're really doing some stuff. But his eagerness of his heart is about restoration. So he waits for the core elements that were the real troublemakers, you know, to die off. And then when there's a first generation that don't know how bad they're supposed to be, you know, then God gives them overtures of grace and tries to reach them. And I will restore their fortunes. I will rebuild this city. And he does that with everything except one city that I know of. So, and it's the people that conquer. It's Babylonia. But we'll talk about that. Okay, you will rule them with articles making pottery. You will dash them to pieces. 10, therefore now, kings, be wise, be warned. Okay, so this is on the basis of what can happen if you're not heads up. Be warned, O kings, heads up, be wise, once ruling the earth. Mishpat, the once ruling the earth. Serve the Lord. Serve the Yahweh. There's that Yahweh. That's that covenant God, that personal God revealing his heart. Serve the Lord with fear, and we talked about the fear was respect or reverence, wasn't trembling like the next word is going to be, and rejoice with trembling. We'll talk about what rejoicing and trembling means a little bit later. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in the way, for he can flare up in a moment his wrath, and blessed are all the ones taking refuge of him. Now, there's an interesting word here that I need to point out. And that's 12. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry. And kiss, of course, was that homage thing, like kissing a ring in the medieval kings and things like that. But the Old Testament is written mostly in Hebrew and a little bit in Aramaic. So sections of Daniel are written in Aramaic. There are a couple of verses in Jeremiah in Aramaic. You don't get a lot of Aramaic, and we'll talk about why in a minute. But this word, son, is Aramaic. See, in Hebrew, the word son is Ben. So, Benjamin, son of my right hand. See, Ben means son of. Right? So-and-so Ben David. So-and-so Ben whatever. Right? But in Aramaic language, it's Bar. So, blessed are you, Simon Bar Jonah, Simon son of Jonah, or Barabbas, son of my father. See, Aramaic, it's got, and this is the word here, is in Aramaic. It just switches from Hebrew all of a sudden to Aramaic. And when you look at what's going on at this time, that the only people that speak Aramaic are kings. And they're rulers at this point. Aramaic will later be what everybody talks. At the time of Jesus, they spoke Aramaic. Everybody spoke Aramaic. The rabbis scrambled to try to preserve national Hebrew and tried to put that in all the schools and the synagogue, force it into the curriculums. And they did okay, you know, but everybody spoke Aramaic. Jesus' normal tongue would have been Aramaic. And by the time we get to like 500 or 600 B.C., everybody all over the world is speaking Aramaic. Okay? Now, but at 1000 B.C., when David is here, the only people that spoke Aramaic were the international couriers, the diplomats, the intelligentsia. It was replacing Latin. There was the original language was Akkadian. There was Sumerian. Remember in our map, gotta draw another map here right quick. When we drew our Fertile Crescent and we put Sumerian Babylon in there, we had a map that looked something like this. We have Mediterranean. Here's Turkey. Okay. Here's Israel. Here's that, other way around, Dead Sea and the Galilee, Jordan. And then we have the Tigris-Euphrates going down here into what's now Iraq, right? Syria. Syria's up here. Iraq, etc. And the two dominant war powers before Dave, right around the time of David growing up, is Assyria and Babylonia. And Babylonia is pure Iraq, and down there is the nation of Sumer. So Sumer, the Sumerians, the first recorded writing we've got, the Sumerians, and history begins at Sumer, it said. They have the first language. They have language hieroglyphics, sort of like Egypt does over here. And so over here, Sumerian is basically the first language. It's really hieroglyphic. It's hard to work with. And so other city-states in that, they come up with Akkadian. And Akkadian is a pretty good language. And it's where you've seen all the little, you know, the ancient languages that look like those little wedge shapes. You know, they draw those little figures like that and crossbars. And, you know, they're wedge shaped. That's cuneiform. And they take a reed and they'd cut it so they made a wedge edge, and then they'd take the mud and they'd stick it in at different angles and at different indentations for the different symbols and signals, and that was Akkadian. And they would put different languages on this symbol set. And so Akkadian. And Akkadian was at first, of course, it was only taught by the scribes and things of this type. And so Akkadian was the intelligentsia, the language of the scribes and the scholars and diplomats and things of this type, until it got replaced by Aramaic because of invasion, basically. Sort of like how Greek took over the world from Alexander the Great. He just ran over here and then taught you a new language, you know. Same thing happened with the Arameans and Aramaic. This kind of, not quite that tight, but close enough. And so Aramaic became the intelligentsia and the language of diplomats, the language of economists, and therefore eventually became our language, right? The language of the people. All right. But at the time, David is saying, "Kiss the son," to the kings, to put the biggest punch on it. He uses their terminology, "Kiss the bar." Okay. So in our psalm, even though it's all Hebrew, there's an element to where he is really addressing this to foreign kings. Okay. I'll do the other nations in a minute. Serve the Lord where we kiss the sun, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in a way, for he can flare up in a moment. His wrath of him, blessed are all the ones that take refuge in him. There's a huge contrast between those who violate, you know, the obedience. They do not submit to this king, you know, and the flare up in a moment thing is one of these interesting things. That when you look at that at first, it's, oh, so this guy's fickle, you know, just... You walk around with eggshells around the sun because the wrath can flare up in a minute. You know, and the thing is that all these kings have been preparing for war, and it's well known that they're, you know, in rebellion against the king and the Lord. And so it's not like you know, he's going to go whimsical on them when they're being good. It's just that they're trying his patience, and he's being very, very patient. But at some point, and the point you know, predict when, right? You're going to step over the line, and then the fury and the wrath, and you're going to go and say, okay, got to catch you guys back. I got to, you know, trim you back a little bit here, dude. So that's what that's about. But immediately after that is this, blessed are those that take refuge in him. Because there is going to come a storm out of Jerusalem to deal with treachery and things of this type, and it'd be better to be, you know, refuge inside of that than being overrun by these other kingdoms. You know, in political alliances on this side, we'll talk about in a minute, in the political alliances, you know, if everybody's going to attack Jerusalem, you say, well, you know, I don't know if I want to do this, guys. Guess what the guys have to do to you, right? Because you're going to be right in the back of the line. There's no better way for you to kiss up to the king of Jerusalem than attack the guys from the rear, right? And so by definition, it's, you know, you become an enemy if you're not a friend. And so that's the part about the refuge. I mean, there were cases where they would do that, where somebody said, I don't want to fight, and they would appeal to the king of Jerusalem and say, hey, they're coming after me, the Jebusites, remember, mm-hmm. the Gideonites. You know, we have a couple of these situations where they appeal, and true enough, the king or whoever's in power at that time comes and bails them out and protects them from taking the right stand in an unpopular situation. Okay? All right, so... this is that royal messianic thing, a psalm. So let's go now over to the next page. And I think I did enough on the English, so let's go straight to the structure. Point A there in the middle of the page, page 13. The rebellious nations, this is the outline of it. The rebellious nations are described in 1 to 3. And then the inside, the inside parentheses is God's rule in heaven, verses 4 to 6. God's decree 7 to 8, and then it backs out to the A prime, the rule of the Messiah on earth. And remember, we talked about the nature of Hebrew poetry is parallelism. And so it's parallelism that can be like a cascade, stair step, the chiasmum that we talked about. And so this is a perfect example of where the outsides match and the insides match an indentation. We'll see this consistently through the Psalms, to where it's just like those little telescoping things. So as you work your way in and you work your way back out, and you can rebuild the structure. Remember, we talked about this was at the campfires, where if you showed up late, you could reconstruct sort of where you were and finish out the psalm on the basis of what you knew, or the story. Okay, so the second psalm is one of the psalms most quoted in the New Testament. It was favored by the apostles as scriptural confirmation of Jesus' messianic office and his expected glorious return with power and authority. Obviously, you don't have a suffering king in Psalm 2, right? You don't have a king. You don't have a king that's like a suffering servant, but you do have a king that's under attack by the foreign nations. But this is a king that's ultimately victorious. And so the apostle said, see, this is going to show his victory, right? Now, let me make a characteristic rabbit trail here. The victory that the apostles celebrate in the New Testament is not the military victory that's here. I mean, we're going to get the military victory at the end of time when it comes to finish cleaning up the thing. But the victory that's celebrated in the New Testament is the victory over what they call the powers. They're spiritual forces that are arrayed against us little humans. It's like Sauron over against us little hobbits. You know, we have no idea what some of these things are, but the angelic forces, they're described in the New Testament. We have so little clue about what they are. You know, all that God has ever told us about them is stay away from them. You are no match for them. Don't go dabbling in the occult. Don't do this stuff. You have no way to protect yourself apart from me. And my protection is safe. Stay away. I'll protect. I won't let them get at you if you don't go inviting them into your life and your situation. And so there's that element to where there's this sinister element that's arrayed against humanity that's up there. And the victory of the cross was over against them. There's a whole issue of that. If you're interested in that, I've got probably 50 hours of audio on the think tank of Sunday school lessons out in California on victory over the powers, if you want to know the background, stuff like that. But that was the first victory was over those that had the way to control the human elements. In other words, there's this interplay that you see in the book of Daniel between spiritual forces and the spiritual and physical leaders. There's some link there that's scary. You know, and fortunately we don't know a lot about it, so we're not terrified of this all the time. But it's definitely there, and one of the ways of trying to leveling the playing field in the human arena is to reduce the impact of the malignant spiritual forces on human leadership. And that's part of what Jesus did over against us by taking away their ability to condemn us on the basis of the cross. So he took away the penalty for sin. He died in our place, made the payment for our sin, so that when a malignant force came up, did God say, okay, well, I'd like to do this horrible thing to Glenn as a judgment on his sin. In previous episodes, I said, okay, well, I sort of can't stop you from that. You know, he's guilty of that stuff, so, you know, just either don't touch his skin or, you know, whatever, like he did in Job. And after the cross, see, there's none of that left. So they go say, Glenn's guilty. And so let me go do this. Oh, I'm sorry. Technically speaking, he's not guilty anymore. Actually, somebody's already taken all that punishment. You've already punished somebody in his place. Remember all the stuff you did that my son on the cross? So actually, you've sort of spent all your bank account there for abusing him. So I'm sorry you can't do it this time. And what they do instead, which is just as effective for me, is they go trick you. They can't do it. They can't force you to do it. You know, they're going to talk you into it. And so they turn salesman, you know, and they'll use deceit and influence and stuff like that to try to get us to mess up and traitor our lives, get off the track for 6 months and a hit, whatever, you know. And so the spiritual forces are involved. But that's what the first victory was against them. So that it helps out tremendously at having a shot at life. Okay, the writers of the Synoptic Gospels alluded to Psalm 2 in their account of Jesus' baptism when the Father proclaimed him to be his son. With the words of verse 7, Jesus introduced the beginning of the Messianic age. So if you remember, we talked about the baptism of John. Remember, we went into John and Jesus were cousins. We talked about the story at the baptism where the heavens open up and God makes the first pronouncement that we know of apart from to Mary. Everybody would have known about it from Mary. Okay. Anytime you did a disclosure like that, you always went and wrote it down. You always got a witness. You always went and shared it with somebody else, you know, to lock it down. Sometimes you actually wrote it down. Anything that was a disclosure from God, you put down in writing. Okay. Because a lot of times it had legal impact. It had legal force if God said, so-and-so will serve the younger in a prophecy. You had to write that down because when it came to inheritance rights, you had to do it, right? So everybody would have known, Mary and Elizabeth, of course, that whole clan would have known that Jesus was the Son, right? So, but here's the first public one that we know of. At the baptism of Jesus, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. So that's the announcement here, and it's the description we, as I mentioned, would have terrified all the scribes and Pharisees that were there, the religious leaders that were there would be scared to death because they were already in a very difficult political situation with Rome. You know, they couldn't really have a king unless it was a puppet king like Herod was. Rome appointed, it was one of the dumbest things Rome ever did. Rome was a very smart nation. And normally what you did is you picked one of your own. When you conquered a country and you had to set up king, you picked one of them. Hello. And you put them there and then they were just a puppet type. And you tried to pick something that was popular. Well, the Jews were so anti-Roman that they really didn't like this. And so none of them, for fear of being, you know, the car being egged every morning and the house being rolled every day, you know, they couldn't volunteer. And so a half-breed, Herod, who was half Jewish and half pagan, which is worse than being pagan into the Jewish milieu, said, hey, how about me? I'm politically ambitious. I'm half them. I could talk these guys into anything. Give me enough money, I'll build the temple for them, which is what he did, Herod's temple. I'll do all this stuff, right? So he goes up there, and he's just so hated because he's a half-breed. And so Rome can never get anything through because their sales guy, their liaison rep, is hated by all the people that he has to serve. And then Herod makes some stupid mistakes because he doesn't know the law. And he builds his temple on a cemetery. You know how bad that is relative to Jewish belief? That is so bad. And so when the Jewish leaders are supposed to come visit and give their status reports, their quarterly audits, and they got to go walk here, you know. This doesn't make for a good thing. Can we meet outside the city in the tent? And Herod doesn't understand this. He doesn't get it, you know. So it's a real bad situation. And so when the announcement comes that when they hear the Holy Spirit come, when they see the Holy Spirit come down, well, we don't know who saw the Holy Spirit, whether it's just John the Baptist or not. We're not clear about that. But the voice was heard by more than John the Baptist, although it was meant just for John the Baptist. Because John the Baptist says in the book of John that said God told him that the way I would know the one would be when I heard the voice from heaven. So we know it was intended for John the Baptist. But if it had gotten public, then the scribes and Pharisees said, "Oh, we're going to have another king." That's what son means to them. See, somebody's going to rule. And if the Romans get wind of this, that we're planning another insurgency, we've got another would-be pretender to the throne. You know, they'll come in and just decimate us. Of course, we'll lose our status, you know, because we're supposed to be helping, you know, control the masses and stuff this life. So it just triggered a tremendous problem for the scribes and Pharisees and the ruling forces. And that's part of what, you know, was the turmoil that Jesus walked right into. You know, I mean, he knew he was going into it. He came in to divide, not to bring peace with a sword. You know, he understood that. You know, the rising and falling of many in Israel. Everybody knew this. It's just that the ruling leaders would hope it wasn't going to be them that did the fall. And it looked like it was going to be. So, next paragraph, the first century church applied the second psalm to the Messiah as an explanation of the crucifixion of Christ by the rulers, Herod and Pontius Pilate, as being these forces that are attacking the Lord and his son, the king and Yahweh and his son, the nations and Israel, the priests, scribes, and Pharisees. They had conspired together against the Messiah of God, in Acts 4. Paul applied it to Jesus' ministry, his sonship, resurrection, and ascension to glory, which confirmed God's promises in Jesus as the Messiah. In other words, he didn't stay dead. He wasn't defeated. He literally came back, took his reign of power. Remember, Paul talked about, in Romans, when he's describing the blessedness of Israel, he says... Even though God has put Israel on the side and is not using Israel for evangelism now, he's taken the broken down Gentiles and the half-breeds to go out and share the gospel, even ministering back to Israel. In this situation, God still loves Israel. They are not in any way rejected by the Lord. He said they are beloved because of the promises to the covenant, to the fathers, but they are enemies because of the gospel, because they fight and this kind of thing. I mean, practically they have an enemy element, but don't you fuss about it. God loves these people. He's got covenant promises. And at the end of time, Romans 9 through 11, God's going to restore Jacob. And Jacob then turns into evangelist and puts us all to shame. Just totally shame. They evangelized the world with the brilliance that they should have had originally. And some of them did have. God fulfills His beautiful promises to the children of Abraham in that way. So when Paul is saying how blessed Israel is, he says they got the law, they got the covenant, they got promises from whom was born the Messiah, born a woman under the law, but declared to be the Son of God in power by the resurrection of the dead. So there's one element where he was declared the Son at the beginning of his ministry, another one where he was declared to be the Son of God in power by overcoming every force that was arrayed against him, death. Political forces, everything. He won that one by resurrection. Okay. Psalm 2:8 is similarly applied in Hebrews, where the glory of the Messiah is the exact representation of God's being, is revealed in Jesus' suffering for sins and His authority at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. In Hebrews 1 starts out, God, who at various times in the past in various ways spoke to our fathers through the prophets, has in this day spoken to us in His Son, who is an exact representation. In the Greek, the word is character. That's the word character that we get the word character from. The exact character of God. If you want to know what God's heart is like, you look at Jesus ministering among the poor, the helpless, challenging the arrogant, the elite, the oppressors, caring for the tenderness, not hurrying things through, but letting them not... one of my favorites just says, when it describes the Messiah, it says he won't quench a smoking wick. He won't finish he lets it finish all the way through the process by itself. You know, he does that in organic processes in our lives, and he just lets things finish, grieving, preparing, learning. Doesn't move on to the next stage. He doesn't quench the wick or doesn't finish breaking the little reed. So if you want to see what God's heart is, you look at Jesus. As Jesus said, he was seen me. Has seen the Father. The Apostle John reveals the greatness of Messiah's victory. He was born of a woman, but is destined to rule all the nations with the iron scepter. In Revelation 12, of course, that's a quote from Psalm 2, that eventually we are going to have, the Messiah is going to come back in power and deal with all of the surface treachery that we see every day and read about in the newspaper. He is the rider on the white horse who will strike down the nations in the day of God's wrath. And the whole point, by the way, of rebellion is not that he likes, you know, wars. It's that you got to do that to get to peace. So you got to get to where after the community has put it up with the treacherous impatience and trying to rehab over and over, and they're still sucking resources and still, you know, blowing people away and still just a drain and you hope against hope, and you hope, and you hope, and you hope, and you hope. Eventually, at some day, you got to draw the line and say, we can't get anywhere with them. We've got to at least separate them, because I promise the righteous that they are going to have peace. And they've been patient with this dude way longer than a normal person would be. And I'll bless them for this. I'll make it up to them and promise it. But eventually, I want them to be able to sleep at peace with their doors unlocked. You know, and the only way I can do this is, one, clean them all up, because inside of all of us is, you know, the same thing that's in the treacherous. So I got to finish that process of what we call sanctification. I got to clean them up, get the chaff out, get where you're pure, 100% wheat, right? And then I got to separate those that are already 100% chaff, that don't have the good element in it for me to peel away too. And so eventually that's got to happen, and sometimes that's going to happen forcibly. Because the treacherous are just not going to go peacefully and quietly into the penal colony or whatever. So, I mean, that's the bad news, but to get there, you have to do that. There's this great phrase at Romans where, I think it's Romans, where it says, the God of peace will crush Satan beneath your feet soon. And so you have the goal, the God of peace, and this extremely violent military metaphor, will crush Satan under your feet, because the only way to get to the peace thing is through crushing the malignancy, getting rid of the thing that will take advantage of leniency and turn it into a weapon. Okay, so that was from the Expository Bible Commentary in the Old Testament. All right, B. The psalm consists of four sections of approximately equal length. So the first one is foreign nations and their rulers express rebellion against God and His king. Remember, they're shaking their fists and they're complaining. Then two, God mocks the might of kings by announcing the installation of a king of His own choosing in Zion. In other words, they want to be king of the world, but God says, well, now, sorry, none of you qualify. You don't have the right hearts for this, so I'm going to put my own in here in power, and I just did it. The Davidic king then speaks and declares the word of God contained in that kingly deed. He said, okay, I'm the king. God has anointed me and put me there. And finally, the nation and their kings are warned of God's wrath and the consequences of His anger and pleasure. Okay? And remember, we talked last time about wrath in the Old Testament. When you get the word, well, generally in all the Bible, when you get the word wrath is a royal term. It's not anger or, you know, the kinds of emotional froth that are anger. There's a separate word, anger, for that. But wrath was a judgment, basically, when the king had had enough. When the king had said, Glenn, you've abused this person enough, I have to come in and intervene here in force. You're not going to like it, but I've got to do it. That was called nakam. That was called wrath. And so all the wrath in the Old Testament is about fixing a problem. It has nothing to do with, I don't like the way you're looking today. It's a bad hair day. I'm going to lash out at you. I woke up on the wrong side. It's not anything like that. It always has to do, it's always typically in the Old Testament preceded by a comment about God's patience. The fact that it's waited this long before it intervened. It hoped you were going to work through the problem with the guy anyway, yourself, and you both were going to go stronger and be able to share reconciliation practices, best practices with other people, but doesn't look like it. So I'm going to have to knock on, intervene here, break you up, discipline you, and then hopefully maybe you'll learn from that, and then you can get back to the reconciliation and do the right stuff. You know, I'm not going to give up on you. I just got to go in and discipline you. That was what knock on typically was. Although it is possible that the whole psalm should be viewed as containing the words spoken by the Davidic king, it is probably better to note the change of speakers throughout the psalm. Right? Now, this is important because there's a good chance this psalm was performed in synagogue. Well, they didn't have synagogues at this time, but performed in the square, in the market square, or later in the temple. From a literary perspective, the psalmist or poet represents a variety of persons, each of whom speaks. First, he presents foreign kings and nations. So look at 2:1. Go back and 2 verses 1 through 3. At the top of page 13. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and His anointing. They say, let us tear their feathers apart. Their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. So if you like divided your room, you know, into four sections, right? So you're going to have a dramatic reading. And so you're saying one group to be the nations. They're going to read that verse and be the mouthpiece of the foreign nations. And then second, he presents the Lord, 4 through 5, who speaks concerning the chosen king. So the Lord in 2, 4 through 6 would be saying, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at him. Then he will speak to him in his anger and terrify him in his wrath. And he speaks, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. And so the back half of the, you know, the back quarter of the room would then do their responsive reading. You know, they would read their part. And then 30 presents the words of that king, the anointed one, who in turn proclaims the divine words of royal proclamation, which is 2:7-9. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will surely give thee the inheritance, the nations as thine inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt shatter them with earthenware. Now remember, that's the king describing what God has said to him. See, the king said, I will declare the decree of the Lord. So these are words from God the Father to the Messianic Son, who's now repeating them in his own voice. And then lastly, fourth, he addresses His own words, the narrator, the person that's writing the psalm, addresses his own words of advice to the foreign nations and their rulers. And the advice is to what? Now, therefore, kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence. Rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, lest he become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath may be soon kindled. But how blessed are those who take refuge in him. And so it has this character that you can see how so many of the Psalms have a dramatic character like this, to where you would remember it. You'd go to Jerusalem three times a year. Remember I talked about this city that was the size of, you know, physically the size of like, physically, you know, maybe the size of Leland. Geographically was the size of Jerusalem, but three times a year, all the males of Israel were supposed to go for the celebration. They were supposed to go for Passover, Jubilee, Pentecost. They were all supposed to go. So the hills here would just be coated with people. It would swell closer to New Testament times after Jerusalem's been restored. The 250,000 people would stop. You know, it was that size, and tents and booths and things of this type, totally all over this place. And so it's small now, but in all these places they would be acting out some of the psalms. They would be reading them in like special, you know, group breakout groups. It was always being in the tabernacle and things like this. And so this would be easily acted out in dramatic character, and a lot of the psalms are like this. Some of the psalms that are recorded in our hymnals, for example, in modern day life, are those responsive readings. For he did this, the mercy of the Lord endures forever. For the Og, king of Bashan, the Lord's mercy is forever. Sion, king of the Amorites. Right. Responsive readings. They go through the litanies. And they were used for this. They were God would bail you out. You would write a psalm, or you'd hire somebody to write a psalm for you. And you'd go tack it up on the wall, basically. And people would use that. And people would come in there and they would read your experience, or have somebody read them to you and say, that's exactly what I'm facing right now. I'm going to try this, Lord. I'm going to take encouragement what you did, this audit trail in somebody's life, and I'm going to trust you for today. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it'll work. And they'd see God had done this little audit trail of hope, and it would show up in the temple, it would show up at the campfires, it would show up when you went three times a year and you were talking about it and having your parties. And so the Psalms were like this. Okay, see. The theme is developed in four balancing sections. We talked about this. The kings who oppose the Lord and his anointed one are invited to take refuge, serving the Lord and paying homage to the Son. In between, two voices are heard. The Lord speaks of the appointment of his Son to reign, 4-6. And the Son speaks of the divine promise of world rule, 7-9. The psalm is rooted in 2 Samuel 7, the promise to David of a supreme name, a relationship of sonship to the Lord, and an enduring line. All right, now we have to stop here for a second and talk about the Davidic covenant. Because this, when David says in Psalm 2, he says, I will declare the decree of the Lord. The Lord has put forth this law, and the law made me his son, and he will be my father, and so I'm a Davidic king. He's quoting something from 2 Samuel, basically. And 2 Samuel is the rise of the Davidic covenant. And here we have to talk and leverage into the enemies that he's describing here. When Israel comes out of Egypt, so back to our map of the ancient Near East, and I'll use a different color for this. Way down here, this is all desert. This is at the time of David, after the judges, this is the Philistines. They've been down in here, and one of the cities is called Gaza. You recognize that? And, of course, the word Palestine comes from the word Philistine. That's how the land is named after the Philistines. Okay, but down here, way down through the desert, mosquito, I guess so, whatever, way down here, all out of scale, is the Arabian Peninsula. And, of course, there's the Red Sea. Egypt's over here. The Red Sea, we got the Suez Canal, and there's this very little small inlet, that's not to scale, obviously, it cuts off here, called the Gulf of Aqaba. And there's a highway that runs from the, well, I've already drawn part of the highway, how about that, such a deal. There's a highway that runs up here called the King's Highway. It was done by all the merchants, and it runs along this little strip here, up to Damascus, one of the major trading centers of the ancient world. Okay, to Damascus, which is up here. And this is the King Highway. When Israel comes out and they cross the Red Sea, okay, at Mount Sinai is somewhere in there. We have no idea where this is. I mean, there are at least five contenders that fight jockey for position as to which one's the real Mount Sinai, because there are a lot of souvenir and tourist trade opportunities available for being the right Sinai. Not that it stops to five, you know. They're going to wander around in here. And when they're time to go up here to the promised land, they're going to the obvious thing to do is catch the King's Highway, right? You get on the King's Highway, you're going to go through here and then cross over at Jericho, and then you're in the promised land. Right? Now, the problem is that the King's Highway, of course, is a well-traveled road, and it goes through A-M-E. It goes through Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And Edom is the other name that was given to Esau. So Esau, of course, was the founder of Edom. When Esau traded his birthright for the red porridge, and the red porridge, red is Edom in Hebrew. And that's how everybody nicknamed him for being stupid, as being Edom. The rest of his life, he's known as Edom. Okay, and so Edom, they're kin, of course, to the Israelites. And so when Moses and them come out here, they send a diplomatic dispatch asking for permission from their kinfolk. Can we come through on foot? We promise we won't get off the highway. We swear we won't raid the land. We won't drink your water. We won't eat your figs. Nothing. I swear we'll stay on the road. And since they don't have a real good reputation because of what's happened to Egypt, overcoming the mightiest empire in the world, perhaps they don't trust them for that reason. You know. And so they say, no, you can't. And Israel wants to go at war because they've just, you know, done some serious damage to Egypt without picking up a single spear. You know, braggadocio when God did all the work on the Red Sea, right? And God sits there and says, don't you dare. I promised this land Esau. And don't you dare take it from him. Don't you even. You go around. Don't you pick a fight with him. See, you know, there's this old it's mentioned in Romans that Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. That's a promise that when he's talking about who's going to carry the promise of the Abrahamic blessing forward. And people say, well, see, you rejected Esau. And remember, hate was just I love less, because we were talking about it just contrast. You know, they go for the Semitic idiom is just everything's black and white. You know, it's all or none. You know, there's no gray areas, but everybody knows there's gray areas. And so you interpret that way. So it wasn't that Esau was hated, because God defended his land right there against his kinfolk. He still gave it to him on a covenant promise. He said, gave all these blessings. So you have to put this in perspective as to what that means. There's no hatred at all about that. It just meant that I picked somebody else. I picked the younger instead of the older to get the blessing. Because I like doing things backwards like this. I don't like the people that are supposed to get it, that have elite position, that have a right to have it, and would therefore believe that they got it for that reason. I'm going to give it to the one who wasn't supposed to get it, the underdog. And so consistently through biblical history, we'll do that. So they say, okay, we get the message. So they're going to go around. Now, going around is this horrible. I mean, these are all mountain ranges, deep mountain ranges. On the relief map that I didn't show you was on the other side of Jordan. Remember now, the Jordan River, this whole thing right here is way below sea level. Remember we saw where the Dead Sea was? Well, this whole fertile valley here, the Jordan Valley from Galilee, is all below sea level. And on the right are all these treacherous mountains and hills, the mountains of Moab and things of this type. And so, for example, if you go see the Sea of Galilee, and you sit there on this side of the bank of Sea of Galilee, you look across it, here are these mountains, you know, 300 and 400 yards high on the other side, called the Golan Heights. And now you understand exactly why the Israelis did not want to secede that to Jordan, their enemy, as part of a peace treaty, because talking about the high ground, I mean, you're right there just overlooking the entire Jordan Valley, the damage that you could do from that vantage place. So it took a tremendous show of faith and getting along for them to secede Golan Heights, or the parts of it, to Jordan. And this is Jordan over here. Moab's going to be Jordan when we get around to the modern version of this. So it's a tough road. The King's Highway was a tough enough road as it was, but it went along the foothills, and you could get through it. And commerce, it was a major commerce. The three main commerce routes came here. Another one came here through Jerusalem and then to the sea. And the third one came along here from Egypt along the coastline. And all the ports were here, Tyre and Sidon are going to be here. And famous ports are going to be along here, Joppa, that Jonah, that Peter goes to, and Stephen. But you got to go through the coast. And the coast people are, I don't know if it's true about all coasts. there are a lot of sailors there, and there are a lot of, not sailors, but tradesmen, that are always through, and there are harbor towns and Shanghai's, and it wasn't the safest route to carry stuff. You normally wanted to sail it and hit those ports if you wanted to. So the King's Highway was one of the best ones for getting up to Damascus. And so they had to go around Edom, and God told them to go around, and so they went around Edom, and then they came in here and tried to go to the King's Highway to Moab. And Moab and Ammon, of course, don't like them at all. They hate them. They're going to fight them because of the history of these people, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But when they... Moab and Ammon... Okay. Part of the reason they don't like the Israelites is because of their relations to Abraham. So do we know who the founders of these people were? They were the incestuous children of Lot's daughters. So when Abraham goes in to when Abraham and Lot's flocks are too big, the carrying capacity of the land is saturated. They got to split up. He lets Abraham, in the goodness of his heart, lets his nephew, Lot, his nephew, pick what area he wants. Well, he looks out over the Jordan Valley and says, man, I want that stuff because it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. As a matter of fact, if you look at that other picture, that's looking on the promised land from right here, one of these mountains in Moab. If you look into that, you can see over on the left the Dead Sea, and you can see all this fertile plain. Now, Lot would have been looking from the other side, but this is what Moses would have seen when God says, you came into the promised land, remember? I told you that a while back, but I will let you see it. So he took him up to Mount Pisgah, which would be over here in Moab, and let him see. And you can see how beautiful the land is, especially if what you've seen for the last 80 years were deserts and mountains. That's a beautiful stretch. And so Lot looked up his eyes. He saw the cities on the plain, how fertile the plain was, and he said, yeah, I'll take that. Abraham said, fine. And so he goes, he settles his tent. Instead of living in the valley, like he told Abraham he was going to do, he moves into the city of Sodom, because they're the wealthiest city on the planet at that particular point, and have the morals to show it. Okay? And so they get in there, and there's that long rescue scene, where God does this rescue and destroys Sodom and Gomorrah, and horrid story, but that's a separate issue. And Lot leaves with his two daughters, who were betrothed to be married to two men in the city, who were apparently part of the crowd that wanted to do all the atrocities to the angels. If you remember the story, that was just a really gross story of what they wanted to do to the angels, homosexual force and violence and stuff like this. And Lot, remember, offers his daughters instead, and we always think, God, how horrible, unless you're trying to play the crowd. And the crowd has got your future father-in-law and the two sons-in-laws that are betrothed to get all your wealth, and you're a wealthy dude, and so your only hope is to split the crowd. See, how about this? And so there's a possibility that there were other things other than just the horridness of what it looked like, that perhaps it was literally a way of working the crowd to try to save the day. Well, it doesn't work, and they stay involved there and push through the problem. And so Lot's daughters go out. They're totally discouraged. Now they're isolated. If anybody hears about what their father does to potential suitors, they'll never. And so they get their father drunk, have sex with him, they conceive. And the child of one is named Moab, and the child of the other is named Ammon. And that's where we get these nations that are renegade offshoots of the of Abraham's family, okay, that are going to always be looked down upon forever by every nation, that's got any ethical sensibilities whatsoever. And so that's Moab and Ammon. Okay? And so they're going to fight to the tooth and nail, and God gives them over. And so when we see a couple of times in the Psalms where they're talking about how God rescues, and he says, Og, king of Bashan, Sion, king of the Amorites, those were two of the kingdoms within Ammon and Moab that God overthrew. They went out to fight Israel. Israel was staying on this little path out here, didn't do anything, but these guys said, not only are we not going to let you go through our country, we're not going to let you go by our country, we're going to go out and attack you, and then God gives them these villages, and then this land ends up being territory for 2.5 of the 12 tribes. Remember, Israel's got 12 tribes, 12 sons of Jacob, and the land is going to be given to them. Well, 2.5 of the 12 tribes, they really like this land over here because they're real big shepherds. And they say, is there any way we can negotiate that we can have some of this land instead of going over? And that's a different story about how that negotiation occurs. And the answer was basically yes. Moses says, it's okay. As long as you help us go in and conquer this, you can then come back and build out your territory here. So they get this. And then, of course, Ammon and Moab grow back and kill off Israel and push them over to the land over time. All right, so they come in here, and then we have the period of Joshua. Joshua takes over from Moses. Joshua does a great job, calls them to the covenant, reminds them, he's steady after this. But they're a tough nation to work with. They're doing well, but they just get lax toward the end. They're doing real well, so they say, well, why should I work hard at it one more time? I mean, I'm doing fine. I just sort of let it go for another day. Come on, let me just relax spiritually just a little bit, you know. Take a break from all this, you know, righteousness and obedience and all kinds of stuff, right? And then they get thrown willy-nilly into the judgment. So they don't drive out the other nations, right, who live among them and, of course, are going to resent them to the day they die, right? Fight them at every opportunity. Saboteur every chance they get. And so then we get into the book of Judges. And the Judges, of course, they don't have a leader. Nobody's paying attention to the law, etc. A real messy situation. And then as these nations get more powerful, and Ammon and Moab and Edom turns hostile, as these start getting more powerful, they start saying, well, you know, I sort of want that land back. You know, you guys, you know, you were powerful, you know, 4 years ago, but God, you guys haven't kept up. You haven't been working out. You know, you haven't been eating right. You know, so I'm like, we're just going to take this land back from you. And so they come, and in the period of Judges, that's what's going on. They're all just taking the land back. The Philistines are rising up. Moabites are coming in, just doing burnt, scorched earth tactics, carrying off the Israelites, selling them into slavery, horrible things. And so Israel says, okay, we give up. We want a king. We need a king, and all they needed a king for was a military leader. You know, they didn't want somebody to actually tax them. You know, but that's exactly what Samuel said. Hey, well, look, God says that here's what you get. You can have a king, but the best of your crops, the best of your kids are going to go to Jerusalem. You know, the taxation, and when you got something that's really prized, you better hide it because the king is going to want it, and we'll move it to Jerusalem. They said, that's okay. We want to be like all the other nations. We want a king. And so they make Saul king. And they pick Saul sort of because he's the tallest guy in the bunch. Right? So he's tall, a little bit of a coward. He has a horrible fear of people and rejection. It gets him in trouble constantly. He won't make tough choices. He won't stand his ground for the Lord. They want to do something, and then he's afraid to buck in the public opinion and things of this type. And so then God does... he gives Saul grace, gives him support in Samuel. Things go pretty well, gives him some victories and things of this type. Even gives him David. Even gives him David as a soldier. David, there's this, and the thing that finally flips it for Saul is when they had victories, the way you celebrated was you partied, right? And you partied and you wrote psalms and you sang at the water holes. Remember we talked about the traveling bards and things of this type? Well, there was this song that all the women with the tambourines, they'd go out dancing and they'd say, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his 10,000. And anybody that knows Hebrew poetry knows that doesn't mean dip. That's just a parallelism. Doesn't mean dip, but what do you think? How do you think Saul took it? He was already paranoid. He said, you know, order magnitude better than me. That's what they're saying. I'm sorry. I think it's actually worth what's next for him but the kingdom. They love him to death, right? Because God blessed him. He's already anointed him, remember. He's already anointed him. So he gives Saul all this grace, and he doesn't respond. And finally he says, okay, enough's enough. The kingdom's getting restless here, so I'm going to make a king. And so he pulls David in. David does the right things. He runs from, he learns discipline. He learns trust in the Lord. He learns to wait on the Lord by being running around in the wilderness of Judea, being chased by, you know, Saul all these years. He learns to trust. He learns to respect God, even when he has opportunities to kill Saul himself. He says, you know, I'm not going to do this. You're not supposed to kill the anointed. I'll let God do that. You know, I'll just show love by saying, I could have killed you, but I didn't. Doesn't this prove my innocence? I don't have anything against you. And Saul would wake up, and for 90 days he was a good friend again. And then he'd forget his lesson and get paranoid again, and because God's blessing wasn't on him and he wasn't walking with the Lord. Well, David eventually becomes king, and then does subdue, you know, a good bit of the nations and things of this type. He does a lot of wars. And at this particular point, there's no temple. Remember, he's living in that little bitty part of the city, you know, a couple football fields in size. And there's no temple, and they're supposed to come together for Passover. Okay, that was in the law, but there's no place for them to come together, sort of. You know, you would normally do it where the king or where the head prophet was, or where Samuel, or, you know, some cultic site, some place where the tabernacle was. And the tabernacle is up in Shiloh, and part of it's up in Bethel. You know, it's scattered around the little pieces that when they carried it through the desert. Right, the little pieces scattered, and they, of course, became idolaters and worshipped, you know, all that stuff instead of the Lord, and, you know, a separate problem. I mean, we do the same thing, just in a different form. But so he says, well, you know, I'm going to build a house for you, Lord. You know, all the other nations have got great temples for their deities. You know, now that we're a real nation, why don't we build you one? I didn't bring my clock. I forgot to bring my clock. What time is it?
8 till.
8 till.
No.
Okay, just check. So make sure I went an hour over already. Okay, just check. All right. So he says, I'm gonna build a house. So he goes and talks to Nathan. And Nathan is Nathan is one of his prophets. We don't know whether Nathan's on the payroll or not, because they had court prophets and they had non court prophets. And the court prophets weren't at this time, the court prophets then weren't, you know, paid political announcements, you know, they weren't, you know, just what the king wanted to hear. They really would rebuke them sometime and speak truthfully, because they were more afraid of the Lord than they were of the king. That changed dramatically over the course of about 100 years. So he goes to Nathan, one of his prophets that he's listened to for, you know, a couple of decades here, and he says, I got this idea. I want to build a house. You think the Lord will let me build him a temple? Nathan says, basically, go for it. He says, go for it. Then Nathan starts leaving. And before Nathan gets too far away, God says to Nathan, now go back and tell him, why did you answer so quickly? Good grief. So you always get in trouble like this, Nathan. You know, you should have thought and said, let me ask the Lord about it. I'll come back tomorrow. You know, now you got to make another trip back up, climb up that Mount Zion thing, you know, because he's already gone back down. And so you got to go back up there and tell him, nope, you're not going to build a house for me. And 2 Samuel 7 is where God says, it was good for you to have this in your heart, to build me a house. But you will not build a house for me because you are a man of war. And there are stories that we won't go into in which David did overkill a little bit. In his warring, he did some... There are a couple of atrocities that are mentioned that are over the line. God says, you know, you did right in your heart here about this. But you will have a son, and he will be a man of peace, remember Shlomo, Solomon, and he will build a house for me, and I will be his son, and he will be my father. And so the Davidic covenant, when Moses takes Israel out, God calls Israel his son. Let my son go to Pharaoh. Okay, Hosea says, out of Egypt I have called my son. Okay, so Israel as a nation had a direct relationship with God of sonship. Not only was he a suzerain, a contract major, not only was he a ruler, a suzerainty ruler that made the contract, the covenant with them to protect them and bless them and nurture them and allow them peace for their communities and their families to celebrate and grow without fear and treachery and things of this type and fear of warfare. Not only was this, he also had an intimate relationship of father to them. Other ancient Near Eastern deities did not do that, by the way. They were the more distant god. They stayed around their titles. They would not use, typically, except of the king, you know, except of the king, I'll be the king's father, but not just the common populace. I mean, we've got to keep hierarchy and structure here. And that's the way the ancient Near Eastern world worked. And but when Israel said, no, we want a king, and Samuel told them, you know, when they were talking about the Saul guy, they said, you have rejected the king, the Lord, from being your king, and you want a human king? And he said, yes, we want an intermediary. We want something in between us here. And so they put a layer in there, right there between them. And then to save the day, God said, okay, well, when I get the right king, I'll just take this relationship down to them. And I'll have that familial relationship with him. I'll have that intimacy. I'll take my son, the king, in, and I'll explain how I look at things. I'll take him on all the trips. I'll explain when I do judgment. Here's what happened. Here's why I did this. Here's why I didn't punish these people, and why I was patient here, and why I'll educate them on what my heart is like. And so the Davidic covenant is the one in which that if the sons of David obey me, then they will never fail to have someone on the throne of Israel. The sons of the kings of Israel fail, starting in the next generation with Shlomo at the last end of his life. The only three things, by the way, it's told in the Mosaic Law when Moses comes out, you know, they don't have a king, right? There are three rules for kings in here, in the Mosaic Law. One of them is you read the book every day, you don't multiply wives, and you don't multiply horses. Those are the only three rules for a king, right? And Solomon's one had 3,000 wives and 10,000 horses, you know. And every biblical mentions that very specifically about, and the wives, of course, were political alliances. That's all they were. I mean, David had 14 wives. And they were political alliances because the Pharaoh, if his daughter went to Jerusalem as the daughter of Shlomo, Solomon, you can bet that the Pharaoh is not going to attack Jerusalem and burn it to the ground in fear, out of fear of hurting his daughter and the offspring and the grandkids. And more mercenarily minded, there's a good chance that his daughter might have a half-Jew, half-Egyptian son who might become king here at the throne of Jerusalem. And then, well, we got free reign over the mass market that they've got there, that trade route. Woo, boy, we're going to be a fat city if that's the case. So there's a lot of machinations that go on with having wives and building their own houses and stuff like that. But they were specifically, that was only three rules for kings, right? They weren't supposed to do this. But Solomon, Shlomo does this, and in David's day, though, let me back up here, and I got to close with this. In David's day, he's that king. He's that son. Because he's a man after God's heart. God's teaching him, showing him how to do this. He's learning at the hands of Saul. He's learning at the hands of the Philistines, at rejection from his people, his abuse by his brothers, looking down on him. You know, but they were always making fun of him. Those little sheep that you protect, you know. I mean, they're always putting him down. They're in the army. He's a shepherd. When it comes time that his kingdom is finally established under God's rule, guess who starts, everybody over here starts attacking. Because now he's going to try to take the ground back. Right? And he's actually going to go back and say, hey, look, we had a deal. I had your land. You know, you didn't fight about it then. You weren't fussing about it then. So why are you doing it now? And so he goes through these wars. And some of these nations that we'll get into, talk about more next time, are these nations here that were kin to them at some level, right, that are now trying to dethrone the Davidic king and get back to where they were during the time of Judges, where they could just run through and steal everything out of the land and sell all the Israelites into slavery, burn the land, scorch the land so they never rise as a political power and things of this type. So part of this raging is going to be people trying to push Israel back to the time of the Judges and exploit their weakness and take advantage of the oppressed. And all the things that God rescued them from out of the Exodus. Okay? And that's the background of Psalm 2, as we're talking about how these kings are interacting with it. And we'll look a little bit more about that when we get into it next week. So let's close in a word of prayer, okay? I'm going to wait for them. Lord, we thank you so much for your love. We thank you for your patience with us. We can never thank you enough, one, for the forgiveness of sins that cost you so dearly on the cross with your precious Son. But we thank you for your word. We thank you for your faithfulness to your people,
your covenant promises to David that spilled over into benefits to us through the Messiah King, your Son. We thank you for your love for your people, Israel, and your faithfulness and the record of that that you gave to us to encourage us, that as you bring us close to you, we can see your love and your redemptive power and your teaching and your training and the hope of just getting to know you better every day as we face these, you know, our own versions of these problems. So we thank you for your word, the freedom that we have here, by the way, to study it openly and freely and with resources. And thank you for these hearts here and their eagerness and tenderness and their relationship with you. And I pray that you further all of us on our spiritual journey this week because of something that we did here tonight, Lord, that you would use this in our life and to grow us more into the joyous and faithful and loyal and incandescent people you would like us to be. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.